Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
This podcast contains explicit language.
This week, the U.S. Senate stumbled forward on tax reform, with a government shutdown looming around the corner.
North Korea launched a missile that could theoretically reach Washington, so we all might die.
And men continued to be bad. Why are bad men being thrown out of their media jobs, but not their political ones?
I'm Elise Foley.
I'm Arthur Delaney.
And this is So That Happened, the HuffPost politics podcast about things that happened in politics.
Hello, this is Arthur Delaney. I'm joined in the HuffPost podcast studio by Igor Bobic.
Hey, Arthur.
And Elise Foley.
Hello.
And this week, tax reform is a hot agenda item. Also, the government might shut down. That's a problem.
Is it?
Well, depends. Now, what's funny about these things,
yes, it is.
These two big things, plus like 100 other moderately big things are all happening at once. The way lawmakers have handled their schedule this year is that everything's coming to a head in December. And at this point, on Thursday afternoon, it does not appear as though there is any plan for keeping the government from shutting down in December. But first, we'll talk about the taxes. It actually does look like Republicans are making significant progress on getting their tax bill through Congress, which is bad news for me because I unnecessarily boldly predicted that this legislation would flop. And in the event that it does not flop, I will have to eat a shit sandwich. So,
that's going to be interesting.
That's not so good. Anyway, Igor, the Senate could vote on this late Thursday night, early Friday morning, or, you know, maybe all hell will break loose and that won't happen.
It's happened before.
But you've been in the Senate covering this closely. How does it seem things are going?
The general atmosphere, and compared to the push to repeal Obamacare, compared to tax reform, is completely different. Basically, every Republican senator sounds like they want to get the yes. The senators who voted to oppose Obamacare repeal last time, Susan Collins, Lisa Murkowski, and John McCain are all on board this time, at least for the moment. It appears like they're going to have the votes to get this thing through.
And but, they're confident. They accidentally tweeted, the Senate Republican account accidentally tweeted that they just passed it.
Really?
And they had to delete that.
That's awesome.
They had to delete it.
Wow.
So they think it's happening. The House already scheduled having to vote on Monday to go to conference. So they think they're going to make it.
Going to conference is a crucial detail here because a funny thing about the Senate legislation that they're preparing to vote for as we speak is that nobody really knows what's in it. They are writing it like on napkins in a cloakroom off the Senate floor.
It's very inspiring to watch.
I am not exaggerating. It's not like there's a deadline for this tax legislation. Like, I know they talk about it being urgently needed, but not.
Trump said he wants a Christmas gift, right?
Oh, right. Yeah. So for Christmas, they want to do
it. It's early still for Christmas shopping.
Yeah, I haven't done any Christmas
shopping. I haven't either.
So the Senate bill repeals the Obamacare requirement that everyone has to buy insurance. Susan Collins said she'd support the bill only if Congress passes a separate piece of health legislation before the conference vote. Here is a little recording I made in the Senate basement with a not ideal recording device.
I am pushing to make sure that they are passed and signed into law prior to the conference report coming back on the tax bill so that I would know for certain that we're going to be able to mitigate the impact of repeal of the individual mandate.
Okay, so this is either an assurance she's really been given or a clever escape hatch for her to vote to approve the legislation but still reserve the right to vote no on the conference committee, which is hopeful for me because, I, like I said, predicted that the tax bill would flop.
I think she's being earnest. She's always meant what she has said throughout this entire process, throughout healthcare, and she stood by her pledge not to support repealing Obamacare. So I think this time she genuinely wants these things in there. The question is whether whether conservative Republicans fall in line and they actually want to vote for some of the stuff that they've decried as, you know, bailouts to insurers. So really, she's making a risky bet as well.
So she says she wants this offsetting beneficial health legislation signed into law before she votes for a final tax package. But and this is where the shutdown drama comes to the fore, because there's a whole bunch of stuff that they're going to have to pass. And presumably Collins thinks that the health care items could just be inserted into a must-pass piece of legislation that funds the government and Elise that would do something for immigrants. Can you explain the DACA piece here?
Yeah, sure. So as people might already know, Trump put hundreds of thousands of young people who came – undocumented people who came to the U.S. as kids – at risk of losing their work permits and, you know, at risk of deportation by ending the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program that was started under Obama, that that they're not losing those protections right away, but people will start to have them expire. They're already having them expire, and they will start to in larger numbers in March. So Democrats have said that they're not – a lot of Democrats have said that they're not going to vote for something, any must-pass bill by the end of the year, unless it has something to help Dreamers, which Trump, you know, has sort of said that he cares about doing. Republicans have said they want to do. But then, you know, they've – a lot of them shown very little urgency on that. So there's this big push from Democrats who know that Republicans need their votes to get anything done here on spending to include that. But as of, you know, Thursday afternoon, there has not been any sort of deal made. Paul Ryan said on Thursday that, you know, well, as far as we know, we have until March 5th and we have other deadlines before then. So it's a huge, huge question mark whether they'll be able to get something like that in. And if they don't get something like that in, there is a huge likelihood of a government shutdown.
So Republicans need Democrats to fund the government. So Democrats have some leverage. And the biggest thing that Democrats want is this Dreamers provision. Meanwhile, Susan Collins also needs Democrats to join with Republicans to pass this health stuff for Susan Collins to support the tax bill. This is before we even get into a bunch of other things that are expiring or have expired, such as Igor, the Children's Health Insurance Program. Mm-hmm. And there could be dire consequences if they don't get that passed as well.
Yeah. One senator I talked to on the Hill today described it as kind of a devil's soup. Like you add in one ingredient that somebody else might not like. You take out another ingredient that somebody wants in there. And, you know, you've got moving pieces everywhere and not everybody's going to be satisfied. And that's the hardest part in trying to wrangle out the votes they need.
But that without the underlying – so the children's health thing expired and it's out of money and some states are going to – run out of money to take care of children, as I understand it.
Yeah, they've got some money already that was appropriated to them that they've been using in order to, you know, keep children on health insurance. But that's going to run out at some point, and they need money badly. I think something like 18 states are projected to run out of money by January. So this is going to get it's got to get done this month, next month, December.
So the tax bill, which is their top priority, is happening in the midst of this devil's soup with just like 100 other problems all coming to a head at the same time. I think that's a good environment for bold predictions. I predict that the government won't shut down. The first funding deadline is December 8th. So that's the soonest it could happen. And they're supposedly saying, well, we'll have a short extension of funding until December 22nd.
Trump said earlier this year that, you know, maybe we need a shutdown.
The president, so, he said that this week.
The problem is that I don't know that that means that he would not sign something if it came to his desk. And I think that there is an understanding with congressional leaders that they do not really want a government shutdown. So I think that they understand it better, the issue, better than Trump does. At the same time, there's a lot of people who have kind of painted themselves into corners here and it'll be hard for them to back off of the things that they've said that they're going to fight for. I don't know. I'm not going to make a bold prediction. I refuse.
Oh, man.
I think it depends on how much faith you have in the backbone of Democrats, which not a lot of people do, because the Republicans have already proven once that they have the backbone to go through with it,
yeah,
to go through the shutdown. But Democrats, I have less faith in them.
Well, and I do want to add that for all of the stories and the talk that Democrats are, you know, going to refuse to vote for anything without a Dreamer protection in it, not that many of them have actually said that they would definitely oppose anything without it. They've said that they want, you know, they want it, it should be in there, et cetera, et cetera. But there's, you know, these little nuanced differences between saying we demand it be in there and actually saying I will vote for against anything that doesn't have it. So, you know, there's some wiggle room.
Well, they've been pretty tight-lipped in general, is my impression, that it's mainly Republicans talking about what has to get done. So they were supposed to make progress on this week with a meeting between Donald Trump and congressional Republicans and Democrats at the White House. And Trump, before the meeting, said, you know what, Chuck and Nancy are coming over, but I don't think you know, we're going to have a deal. And then Chuck and Nancy said, well, fine, we're not coming. And that was actually like a huge setback.
And this was Wednesday on Days of Our Lives.
Yeah. It's ridiculous. So.
Well, they said, fine, if you won't make a deal with us, we'll just work with McConnell and Ryan and we'll make a deal. That's how we do better anyway. And then McConnell and Ryan said, no, we're going to the White House. And
they staged that photo chop with some empty chairs.
Yeah, so everybody basically just dug in their heels and refused. Now nobody's talking to each other.
It recalled the.
I think that they are behind the scenes.
It recalled the Clint Eastwood empty chair from the 2012 Republican National Convention.
Yeah, it was a good stunt pretending that they just could not move those Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi name tags off the table. They definitely were going to sit flanking him, all of them having a meeting sitting on the same side of the table.
I like that. I thought it was clever.
It was funny.
I think most people.
Yeah, I'm not mad about it. I'm just.
Republicans spun that as fake. Chuck and Nancy completely owning themselves by not trying to negotiate with Trump, who'd proven pliable to them in the past. But I don't know. It's a pretty unpredictable situation. I already feel dumb about my bold prediction.
I mean, there's been times in the past, sure, where they've done well in their negotiations, their deals with him. But then there are other times where they came out of a meeting and said, oh, we came to a deal on the Dreamers and border security. And then he backed out of it. So, you know, I think negotiating with Trump is a real crapshoot.
All right. Tax reform and government shutdown are coming. We'll be right back.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why United Healthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Back. Hi, it's me, Arthur Delaney, and I have a special request. If you like So That Happened, please consider giving us a shout-out on iTunes. Give us 4 or 5 stars. Please don't give us fewer than 4, though. Think of us as like an Uber, but for political commentary. So if we get a low rating, they'll take our car away. Thank you. And we're back. This is Arthur Delaney. I'm joined in studio by 2 foreign policy experts. One of them is HuffPost's own Jessica Schulberg.
Hello.
And the other is a very special guest, Mike Fuchs, a foreign policy expert and senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. Hello.
Hi.
So North Korea, are they going to blow us up? That's right. I mean, they launched a huge missile And everyone was surprised by how far it could go. And they said that theoretically they could blow up Washington, D.C. with a missile that goes the distance that that one could. So they're going to blow us up, Mike?
I'd say don't curl up in the fetal position just yet.
Okay.
But get a little bit nervous. So what the test this week proved was that North Korea has the ability now to launch a missile that could reach basically anywhere in the United States. What we don't know is whether or not they've mastered the technology to actually miniaturize a nuclear warhead, put it on top of that missile, and then launch it into the atmosphere and have it survive going into space and coming back into the Earth's atmosphere. We don't know yet whether or not they have that capability. So may still be a little bit of ways away from it, but they're getting pretty close.
Because they have nuclear bombs, like huge ones, that they blow up on the floor over there. And they separately have these rockets that go really far and high.
Yeah.
But you can't just tape the bomb to the rocket and have it work.
I mean, they could try. I'm not sure it would work.
You could try.
So what is the response from Washington? Donald Trump was just like, you know, we'll take care of it. Like, okay, great. You know, you have sort of presided over a continued escalation. It seems like the most rapid escalation of tensions between the U.S. and North Korea in the last, what, 20 years? Maybe it's just the continuing of what had been going on before. Can you please, the two of you, disentangle to what extent this is like the Trump administration's doing and just the status quo from before?
I think most of it's a continuation of what was going on before. North Korea was definitely rapidly advancing its missile technology even before Trump came into office. I think on the North Korean side, there was a little bit of a hope of maybe a restart with the Trump administration. And they did hold off on tests right after the election for a couple months. Trump then came in with this very, very aggressive rhetoric, these personal insults against Kim Jong-un, calling him Little Rocket Man, and kind of calling his bluff, kind of daring him to prove that he could actually hit the U.S., threatening that the U.S. Could engage in regime change or military interference over there. So I think he's definitely not helping a very fragile escalatory situation, but I think it would also be a mistake to say that this is all a direct result to our beloved president.
So, Mike Fuchs, if Donald Trump were not calling Kim Jong-un short and fat, this might be happening anyway.
Yeah, right. Instead of having your usual scenario for the past couple of decades of a toddler coming from North Korea and acting, like a 3-year-old in terms of the way they talk with the threats and all the rest of it, we've now got two of them on both sides. So,
because North Korea always makes these really weird statements that are like threatening and macho.
Oh, yeah. And they create these crazy YouTube-style videos that look like they were made in someone's basement of sort of, you know, Washington, D.C. or some other American city blowing up. Again, this is sort of, you know, par for the course for North Korea. What they've never experienced before is a counterpart that did something similar. And I think they found that in Donald Trump. So if we didn't have President Trump, it's hard to know exactly what would be going on today. I think some people believe that Kim Jong-un would be also racing towards the capability to reach the United States with a nuclear warhead. This is something North Koreans have been wanting for many years. But I think I completely agree that President Trump's rhetoric, his taunts, his insults have escalated tensions. And frankly, I think it's made it more difficult to engage in the diplomacy that's necessary.
Well, speaking of that, this is happening simultaneously with other foreign policy developments. Namely, there's like turmoil at the U.S. Department of State. On Thursday, we heard that Trump was possibly going to ditch Secretary of State Rex Tillerson in favor of the current CIA director, Mike Pompeo. That can't help. I mean, I know there's not a lot of people who talk to counterparts in North Korea specifically, but
Pompeo is definitely not one of them.
Right. So how does that State Department stuff affect how we handle North Korea?
Well, it's not even just the State Department. If Pompeo left the CIA, it's been reported that perhaps Tom Cotton, who's a very hawkish Republican senator from Arkansas, could be in line to replace him at the CIA. I have a hard time believing that that could clear a Senate confirmation. But if that were to be the case, you'd have these two very ideologically driven men, Mike Pompeo and Tom Cotton, at the head of our intelligence bureau and our diplomatic headquarters.
And those two men don't inspire a ton of confidence that we would be able to engage in this sort of delicate back channel beginning of diplomatic engagement with the North Koreans, which at this point is kind of our only hope. I mean, everybody freaks out every time there's another launch out of North Korea and says, oh my God, now they can hit the U.S. The reality is that they've been steadily advancing in their capabilities for years now. They probably aren't going to stop until they get the exact capability they want. And then they can come to us and say, hey, we can blow up D.C., want to talk.
No, look, I mean, I completely agree with that, although I will say on the issue of North Korea in particular, an issue of this importance, level of importance to the United States, direction really does come from the top. It comes from the president and the White House. And for months now, all reports indicate that Secretary Tillerson and his team have been wanting to push diplomacy, but frankly have been held up by President Trump's activity, his words, and the White House's guidance. And so, again, a change at the State Department or at the CIA may not actually affect that at the end of the day.
That's right. I recall specifically Donald Trump saying, hey, Kim Jong-un, don't bother talking to Rex Tillerson. It's a waste of time.
And then Rex Tillerson says, yes, we're pursuing all possible methods of diplomacy. And Trump tweets the next day, no, diplomacy is a waste of time.
Right. So around that time, it came out that Tillerson had called Trump a moron. And that was like a big news cycle for. But Jessica, you have reported how we do have a sort of informal diplomatic relationship with like a couple people from North Korea, and they meet in an office above a Hallmark store in New York City. So that's just going to keep – that's the main thing that's going on, right?
Right. I mean, these days I think – so those are North Korean ambassadors who are based out of the North Korean UN mission in New York. And there's a couple people there who sort of have the U.S. portfolio. Their job is specifically to report back on what the Americans are thinking, what the response from Washington has been, and also to be available to meet with either diplomats from the State Department or what they call Track 2 diplomats, which are people from think tanks, professors, academics, just North Korea experts who have diplomacy-minded objectives, and they sort of serve as this unofficial liaison between the North Koreans and Washington. I think Mike could probably speak better to
so it's
how effective
well, it's,
that
it's
is.
It's reassuring that that exists instead of just nothing. Because
sort
when
of.
There's – oh, sort of? Oh.
everything that seems reassuring about North Korea policy is only sort of reassuring.
Like it's better than the worst case scenario.
Exactly. It's never that good. But on the diplomacy, I mean, look, for years, the sort of bottom of U.S.-North Korea engagement is through what's called the New York Channel, which is basically through the North Korea's offices at the United Nations, where relatively lower-level diplomats would engage with one another to make sure that certain messages were being passed back and forth. If you needed to complain about something in particular, you go up there and you wag your finger a little bit and make sure the message is going to get through. But and higher level diplomatic talks, they don't really exist right now. They've only been sporadic in the past. And we have no direct immediate line of communication. There's no U.S. embassy in Pyongyang, no North Korean embassy in Washington. So if there was a crisis that broke out and you needed to urgently pick up the phone and get in touch with, say, your foreign minister counterpart, that wouldn't be quite as simple as it would with any other country.
And I understand that having that kind of relationship is important for like avoiding an accidental conflict. Like a plane crashing or something like that. So if a conflict does happen, my understanding is that South Korea would basically be attacked and that our allies in the region would be in more trouble than the United States itself, you know, the long rocket notwithstanding. Like that's the problem here, right?
Yeah. I mean, look, as scary as it sounds when the headlines read, you know, North Korea missile can reach the United States, the reality here is that the situation has not fundamentally changed for decades. For many, many years, North Korea has had the ability to completely destroy Seoul, the capital of South Korea, and much of that country, frankly. And that's not just about South Koreans. That's about Americans. We've got more than 28,000 American troops stationed in South Korea. There are hundreds of thousands of American citizens living in South Korea. So this game of deterrence that we've been playing with North Korea for years, frankly, still remains.
It's not just Trump and Kim Jong-un, though. We have allies and frenemies in that region. What are they doing differently now, if anything?
Well, I think, look, I mean, Japan, which is our other major ally in Northeast Asia, takes a pretty hard line, especially under its current prime minister, Shinzo Abe. They don't like seeing North Korea do what it's doing.
Rockets go over Japan.
Right, exactly. And they feel threatened, obviously. And Shinzo Abe has created a pretty good relationship with Donald Trump so far. So they've been pretty hand-in-hand, Trump and Abe, in speaking very loudly and getting very tough on North Korea. On the other hand, you got China. And China has always been stuck between a rock and a hard place on North Korea. On the one hand, they don't like North Korea. North Korea is kind of a pain in the behind for them, you know, constantly launching off rockets, creating pain for them in the international community. Everyone wants China to solve the problem. So they don't like that. At the same time, they don't want the United States, which has troops just over the border in South Korea, to successfully help unify Korea, which might mean there was a U.S. ally with American troops right up against the Chinese border. They don't want that to happen either, and they don't want the chaos of regime change and instability in North Korea. So they always find themselves trying to do a little more, but not quite so much as they would destroy the regime.
So China is muddling through, but President Trump is constantly tweeting at Xi Jinping like, do something. You know, why don't you do something? Right? That's how I read Trump's tweets, as like, come on, man. Like, just sort of nagging him.
Why haven't you fixed this?
Yeah.
And depending on the day, I mean, Trump's interpretation of whether or not China's done enough, even that changes. You know, sometimes you say, oh, look at all these things that China's cut off to North Korea. They're really taking it seriously. They listen to me. I'm strong. I'm powerful. Everything's great. And then, you know, a week later, he's pissed off at China and he says that they could fix this crisis in a second if they want, and they just won't do it, and they're bad guys.
Yeah, I mean, Trump seems to act like a guy who's read one too many news stories about how Xi Jinping and China is the answer to North Korea, when, of course, they're part of the solution, but they're not the entire thing.
Yeah, it seems actually like his understanding of events might be somewhat superficial. Maybe if he read one or two more stories.
And maybe tweeted a few fewer times, things would be better.
All right, well, hopefully we don't die. Mike Fuchs from Center for American Progress, thank you so much for coming in. Jessica Schulberg, thanks to you as well. We'll be right back.
And we're back. This is Elise Foley, and I'm here with HuffPost Arthur Delaney.
Hello.
And Marina Fang.
Hi.
And we're here for our now seemingly weekly segment on creepy men. So, you know, hopefully maybe someday we'll get to stop doing these. But the basic rundown this week, and you guys can jump in if I've missed anybody, we are up to 6 accusers of creepy conduct by Al Franken, the senator. We have multiple people who have said they were sexually harassed by Congressman John Conyers. Matt Lauer is now out of a job because of sexual harassment. Garrison Keillor, Russell Simmons. I probably have forgotten some people, but
a CNN producer.
Yes. And basically what we wanted to talk a little bit about is a recent piece that you did, Marina, about how differently things are handled between Hollywood and also corporate America these days, and politics, where it seems like you can go on and be, you know, clearly the president or all sorts of other things and, you know, have all these skeletons in your closet and nobody cares. Maybe get elected.
Yeah. So I wrote this last week, but I mean, it continues to be relevant seemingly every day. And it focused on Hollywood specifically, but I mean, it really applies across the board, just politics
public
versus
figures kind right. of who aren't in politics.
Right, exactly. In in entertainment, in media, even in Silicon Valley, basically the problem, there are a couple of problems, and a lot of these reasons are kind of baked into each other, but the obvious difference here is that politics is involved. And so when people have these partisan and ideological concerns, they're going to put those ahead of their moral compass. And we've seen this a lot with Roy Moore and his supporters. Many of them don't seem to care about these pretty morally terrible allegations and just continue to deny them.
Or at the very least say that, you know, we do care. We don't want – it's pretty bad that this guy is probably a pedophile, but it's worse that, you know, Doug Jones, his Democratic opponent,
right. Trump himself
doesn't oppose abortion.
Has said that.
Yeah.
Right. They don't want, quote, a liberal person in there. They want their, you know, tax reform vote. They want their Supreme Court justices, et cetera. But another reason is that there just isn't any sort of mechanism to remove people from office very quickly. There's really just voting. One of the academics I talked to said that voting is a very imperfect mechanism for removing someone because you only have elections every couple of years for the most part. And then in Congress, you have this very elaborate Byzantine process of reporting sexual misconduct incidents that often doesn't really go anywhere. You have ethics investigations, but that, again, that takes a long time. Conyers is currently undergoing an ethics investigation, as is Al Franken, but these can take months, perhaps even years. Whereas in corporate America, in, you know, in entertainment, in media, a lot of these businesses realize, okay, this is a moral and economic liability to have a sexual predator or alleged sexual predator in our company or as the host of our show or as the star of our movie. So we're going to decide to remove him.
This is maybe a crass moment to make the point, but it partly reflects the fact that with at-will employment, which is the typical arrangement in the United States, you can just fire someone on the spot at any time.
Right.
Like, we have weak worker protection. So the private sector, if they have a creep on their hands, it's like, see a creep.
Yeah, they manage that. The Matt Lauer news, they said that somebody came to them, the executives, I believe, on Monday night. And by Wednesday morning, he was out of there. So, yeah, they can respond really quickly. At this point, now we have Nancy Pelosi, Paul Ryan calling for Conyers to step down. The problem, right, is that they can't make him do that. He has to decide to do that.
And his attorney actually said that. He said, well, okay, Pelosi and Ryan have the right to say that, but ultimately it's up to Conyers to decide. And he, through his lawyer, has been very defiant. Continues to deny all of these allegations and says that he won't step down.
And we should say, as we record this, he's currently hospitalized. So for stress is what they have said.
Right. I think
so. He has not spoken today. Thursday. But his attorney did speak, you know, on his behalf and was very stubborn about, you know, no, Pelosi can say what she wants, but he gets to decide.
Another congressman made an interesting point, defended him. It's the flip side of the accountability question when you're elected.
Right. You're talking about Clyburn. Right?
Right. There's no mechanism for immediately throwing them out. And there's also this rhetorical point that Clyburn made in this clip
exactly.
We've got here.
It's the exact point of this piece I wrote, pretty much. It kind of encapsulates all these problems.
All right, let's listen to the clip.
Other men in other industries have faced similar accusations and gotten out of the way, resigned, stepped down far faster than he has. Right?
I know you would have to give me some examples.
Harvey Weinstein, Charlie Rose, Matt Lauer.
I don't think they. Who elected that?
Right. I don't think they stepped down.
So it's different because he's elected.
Okay, so that was Clyburn. He later, though, did say that he thought Conyers should step down, which I think kind of also shows that there is a push on these other elected officials to condemn their colleagues, which is something that, you know, maybe is somewhat new to the current moment that we're in. So that's notable. I think that they, you know, a lot of people have come out pretty quickly against their colleagues. However, their colleagues have not actually stepped down. So it's kind of an interesting thing. Pelosi got a lot of flack for to some extent defending or praising Conyers.
Yeah,
and then ended up backing away from
that. Initially also didn't believe the women. She said, oh, like, they're anonymous, I don't know who they are. But then she later backtracked and said, I've spoken to one of the accusers, one of the named accusers, Melanie Sloan, who is an attorney who used to work for Conyers on the House Judiciary Committee. So Pelosi said, oh, I spoke to her and now I believe her.
Had there been any widely known reason to be skeptical of the Conyers accusers? But at the time that Pelosi said, you know, I don't know.
So she said this on Sunday. This was after Melanie Sloan had come forward. So I guess she just, maybe she didn't know. But I think to your point, Elise, like, part of the other thing that's changed is that I think people are more, they're willing to believe the accusers more than they were maybe
And what I'm curious to see is whether, because another thing that happened this week is that the House voted to require sexual harassment training, and that's going to be every session and include members and also staff. And that's great, but Politico reported that Conyers' office already had sexual harassment training. So you can put people through training, and people, you know, should go through training, et cetera. But the biggest problem we have is these people who are in power and think that they can, just because they have power, they can do whatever they want and they can sexually harass people. I think that, you know, possibly the way that we can prevent this from happening is having a climate where women feel, or anyone who's harassed, feels comfortable coming forward and reporting it and naming, you know, naming these people. And so I think that that could be a way that things could change potentially, is that, you know, you see more people, more, as more women come out and are believed and the men suffer some sort of consequences, then maybe there will be fewer creepy men. I don't know. That's my hope.
Yeah. That, and also just having a better process for removing people. Like I said, in these situations where it's not involved politicians, you know, the board of a company can unilaterally make this decision. And they also have their consumers in mind, or their viewers or their audiences. They don't
want to do something that looks bad on them.
Right.
They didn't want Matt Lauer going out there on Wednesday morning, the same day that, you know, this was going to get reported in Variety and New York Times were both looking into Matt Lauer, had been researching Matt Lauer stories for a while. They don't want him out there in the Today Show and all the viewers being like, excuse me, what is that creep doing up there? I just read about him having some, you know, button that locks his door at his desk.
Oh, my God. That was creepy.
Now, apparently a lot of people have that as a security measure, which
not a good example.
I don't understand
allegedly
why that.
Allegedly gave a coworker a sex toy. That's another thing.
And exposed himself.
Yeah. There are many, many creepy things by him.
But going back to the point of, like, having a mechanism for removal, I think one of the biggest things that this is exposing in Congress is that this process for reporting sexual misconduct is just so ineffective. A lot of critics have said that it really doesn't help the accuser at all. It benefits the perpetrator.
Shocking that Congress would put something in place that benefits themselves.
Right. And that's another big difference in these different cases.
Now, they have voted, I think, this week to institute training.
Right. But as Elise was saying, like, that's just, you know, a drop in the bucket when it comes to the actual reforms that they need to take. We should mention that Jackie Speier, the Democratic congresswoman from California, has a bill called the Me Too Act, which is supposed to address this larger overhaul of the process. But that seems to be more like slowly moving through at this point.
I mean, who knows, though? It might get a boost by more people being exposed. I think there is pressure on, you know, clearly politicians to speak out against this stuff. So we'll see. Maybe that bill will have more success than expected.
Maybe.
But anyway, well, thank you for coming in and talking about it. I'm sure we'll have more to update listeners with soon about.
Yeah.
Do we have any bold predictions?
Bold predictions.
Will Franken step down? They're starting to pile up.
They're really starting to pile up with him. And I think one of the notable things with his is that he keeps saying he doesn't remember, which either he does and he's lying, or if he doesn't truly doesn't remember and they truly did happen, that means he does it so much that he can't remember.
And it's like it's like butt grabbing. Like, you know you're constantly grabbing people's butts.
Okay. I know that I'm not. So, yeah, I think that he'll resign.
Yes, that's
bold. I think Conyers will resign.
Those are bold predictions.
Those are my bold predictions.
I second.
They're probably wrong.
I second those bold predictions.
I don't know. I was about to say that by the time listeners hear this, there will probably be more alleged sexual predators revealed. That's not a bold prediction at all.
That's not like, bold.
That's probably going to happen.
That wasn't bold at all, Marina.
Bold at all. Oh. Well, thank you, Marina and Arthur, and we will have more to come.
So that's what happened this week. This podcast was produced, edited, and engineered by Zach Young. Our executive producer is Nick Offenberg. I'm Arthur Delaney, and this week we were joined by HuffPost reporters Elise Foley, Igor Bobic, Jessica Schulberg, and Marina Feng, as well as Mike Fuchs, senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. So That Happened is available on Apple Podcasts. Check out the whole family of podcasts in the iTunes store. And while you're there, subscribe and tell your friends. If there's something you'd like to hear us talk about, send an email to sothathappened@huffpost.com. Thanks to all of you for listening.